All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back. Taxation is theft. Man, and I forgot to turn my mic on. What a day. What a day of technical difficulties. I'll get to that in a minute. But first, welcome. Taxation is theft. This is the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off, broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube and a couple other places from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico. I'm Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, former candidate for President of the United States, currently in the race for Governor of Texas. And I'm required by law to tell you that you must stand within 6 feet of your speakers when listening to the show, or you might get the coronavirus. Today, I'm supposed to have Adam Kokesh, but we are running into some technical difficulties, and I think the NSA might be involved. We'll find out in a minute. But... all right, I think he's on his way. Before we get started, as usual, I want to take a quick minute to ask for your support for Taxation is Theft. Taxation is Theft is, of course, the organization where we spread the word that taxation is theft all around the world. Funny story, Vermin Supreme was just live streaming, and I asked him in a question, what is the meaning of life? And he said, the meaning of life, Daniel Berman, is to make sure that everybody in the entire world knows that taxation is theft. And that's what we do here. We've reached people in Australia, in Pakistan, in Uganda and Kenya, Spain, Sweden, London, UK, you name it. We reach everybody around the world, but we're doing a lot of damage in the United States. Damage to the omnipotent state, of course, I mean. We really are getting this message out there to millions of people. But, of course, we need support in order to do this. You don't have to just throw money at us. Of course, if you want to throw money at us, we'll take it. But you can buy a really cool hat like the one I've got on, a flag, all kinds of t-shirts and other swag that we have on the store. All of that supports us if you want to help us thwart the deceptive nature of the government with our counter-propaganda campaigns. So, Adam's running a few minutes late, but I know some of you guys were very anxious, and I didn't want you sitting there, what's going on? So, I started the live stream up. And I guess there's a few things I could talk about while we're waiting on Adam. Because it's 9/11 today, and I did this on purpose because he is a veteran. He served in Iraq, and I thought it would be fun to have this conversation. But I guess let's since some of you guys are starting to tune in, what are your favorite conspiracy theories about 9/11? Let's have some questions and comments and let's have a go at 9/11. Does anybody think that it was really some guy in a cave on the other side of the world who orchestrated an infiltration of the complex security? I know that's kind of a joke, right? Complex security, you think of TSA, but before 9/11, we didn't have TSA and we had actual security, private security. The Pentagon was never hit by a plane. I've heard that one. I've seen the arguments for that, and it's really hard to say that it was. I've seen more evidence that says that it wasn't than I have that says that it was. Now, of course, with the way this works, because you can't prove a negative, right? You can't prove that it wasn't hit by a plane. But that's the whole point of innocent until proven guilty, right? Innocent until the reason we have innocent until proven guilty is because we know you can't prove somebody's not guilty. We know you can't prove that somebody wasn't there the night of the murder. Or maybe you can, but you shouldn't have to, right? Because let's say they were just sleeping, nobody saw them, no witnesses, nothing. You can't prove a negative, not all the times. Sometimes you can prove an opposite, but you can't prove a negative. And that's why in that type of trial, we have the burden of proof on the prosecutor to prove the positive, to prove that somebody did this. I'm just sending a message to Adam to let him know what he's prepared for. He's coming in hot as soon as he tunes in. So, did something happen? Well, your friends might gossip to you and say, like, oh my God, did you hear what happened at school yesterday? Did you hear what happened at work yesterday? Did you hear what Joe did? And like, it might be something unbelievable, like he got caught Xeroxing his ass in the copier room. And you might be like, oh my God, that's unbelievable, but yeah, I believe it. And then Bob tells you, no, that never happened. You're probably still going to believe it anyway, right? And so, but there's never really any proof as to whether or not he did it, unless you get the smoking gun, the picture from the Xerox. And of course, then you can say, well, that's not mine. Then you'd have to do like the naked gun where you have to pull his pants down and say, look, it is his ass. I picked a really terrible analogy for this. But my point is this. With the Pentagon, did a plane hit it? Somebody can say the plane hit it, and you might believe them that the plane hit it, but that's not absolute proof, right? And just like if Bob had gone along with the story and said, yeah, that was me Xeroxing my ass, that still doesn't mean that he actually did it. Maybe he's just going along with the joke. Now, of course, 9/11 was not a joke. The Pentagon is not a joke. But all of the same rules apply. We have different reasons for wanting to believe a story that we were told, but just because we want to believe it doesn't mean it was true. Just because it came from a trustworthy source does not mean it was true. Because, I mean, let's be honest, who really trusts the government? And it's interesting because a lot of people, you can ask them that question. I think this is one of Adam's favorite questions. Do you trust the government? And people will say, no, usually. But then if you ask them, so why would you trust them about what's... Well, that's different. That's big. That's important. That's an exception. It's an exception to the rule, right? That's really interesting. So people will defend this. But I think even deeper than that, people will defend this because they're afraid. It's a survival mechanism, right? Because we live in a world, and this world is viewed through the lens of our own eyes and our own perceptions and impressions of what things are, right? Some people will walk around in the same world together. Some of them say, oh, this is wonderful. Look at all this. And somebody else will be, oh my God, this is miserable. Look at everything. Same two people, same situation. And it all has to do with our perception. So some people, in order to feel safe, because we all like to feel safe, right? Some people will change their perception of the world around them to make themselves feel safe. They'll do it by denial. Oh, no, that's not a threat. That's not scary. That's not there. All these kinds of things. This is what we do to ourselves. It's absolutely insane. But that doesn't change the facts, right? So going back to the facts, did a plane hit the Pentagon? I've seen a lot of evidence that says no. You look at the size of the hole. That couldn't have been done by a plane. Now you say, okay, but all you need is one piece of positive evidence, right? I mean, look at the OJ trial. All of these excuses they had to say, he didn't do it, he didn't do it, he didn't do it. If the glove doesn't fit, you must have quit. He didn't do it, right? But if all you had was one video of him actually doing it, no question, all of the things about like, oh no, that couldn't have happened, all the questionable evidence, everything, none of that would be relevant because you'd have absolute proof of video. Of course, these days you'd probably argue that the video's fake, but it's another story. So when it comes to 9/11 and the Pentagon, where's the actual evidence? And I'm not saying this to be a conspiracy theory. I'm not going to say Bush did 9/11. Although I love saying Bush did 9/11. It's fun. It just rolls off the tongue. But we have to ask that question. Where is all this evidence? And we saw a little bit of evidence. And it's like, that doesn't really make sense. It doesn't add up. We have to be real with ourselves. We have to consider. We have to, and this is very difficult. We have to understand how our own brain works and that we're going to set ourselves up to blind ourselves from the truth. That's natural. I don't care how woke you are. I don't care how many red pills you take a day. Red pills give you wings. None of that matters. None of that matters. Bush did 9/11. Someone just commented. James. We have to understand that about ourselves. Because if we don't understand that, we're going to continue to go further into that web of lies. Okay, and without further ado, here is Adam Kokesh. All right, he's coming up. Yo! Welcome. Yeah, absolutely. I gave you a short introduction earlier. I let everybody know that you were coming. We were just chit-chatting about the Pentagon and 9/11 and the conspiracy theories. Now that you're here, welcome. Adam is, of course, one of the former presidential candidates. Had an awesome time running a campaign with him. With him, against him, however you want to call it, pretty much with.
We got a great candidate with Joe Jorgensen. And I understand people want to say this and that now that she's the nominee and she's running. But as a libertarian, I am grateful that the Libertarian Party nominee for president in 2020 is actually going to represent a message grounded in principle, not resume or celebrity or practical policy. And Joe Jorgensen is in that sense, head and shoulders above some of the other, nominees who we've had recently.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think she was, I have to say, she is so much better than what we've been getting. And, you know, you talk to, Arvin Vora, and he's like, well, that's because of everything that we did. Like, he's convinced.
Yes.
And so
yes.
we kept out the Lincoln Chafees or, you know, that. And I hate saying that because, like, he's a nice guy, but he's a fucking politician.
Yeah, of all the people that we want to, who've tried, who we're like kind of offended by, like, you're going to represent the LP. I would say the same thing about Gary. As much as I dislike Gary Johnson as the nominee, as much as I dislike the idea of even Justin Amash, who would have been better than these others I'm going to mention, Lincoln Chafee, but even Bill Weld. Like, I want to point this out to people to appreciate and to bring a little humanity to these people that we're talking badly against right now. Because it's so important to remember 9/11. No, wait, actually, if I may, do you mind if I do a big, like, sidebar to come back to this point?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to get my own personal plugs in here, right? I did my show this morning, as I do Monday through Friday, 9 to 11 a.m. Pacific time, adamversustheman.com. And yesterday, and this is, you probably want to come back to this. Yesterday on YouTube, we published a video about the false positive COVID test numbers and the fact that Britain is going to test all of their population. Well, if they use a test that even has 10% false positive, not like the 1/3 false positive that we've seen with some of the tests promoted by the US government, well, you're never going to fucking recover from the virus. 10% of your population will always be sick. Like, it's managed. And that video not only got censored, got pulled off of YouTube, it got flagged for impersonation. I don't think I did a Trump impersonation in that segment, but if I did, I know for a fact my Donald Trump impersonation is not that fucking good. I do a pretty good Donald Trump impersonation. but I do a perfect impersonation of Trevor Noah doing a bad impersonation of Donald Trump. Okay, yeah, I need to appreciate that. And so we were also banned from posting and streaming on YouTube for 7 days. So I can't stream on my own website now because we were using YouTube and porting it to AdamVsTheMan.com. So today's show was just about, well, we had that censorship. We had a great guest with Kristen Harris about the Kenosha shooting and his footage there, and Jason Burmes. Is that a blast from the past name for you, Dan?
Jason.
You remember Jason Burmes? Loose Change. The original Info Warrior. He was a sidekick to Alex Jones. Do you remember back when Alex Jones was libertarian? Before he was more concerned about, you know, he was concerned about freedom and the Constitution and supporting Ron Paul. And then somehow he was like, they're making the frogs gay. Nominate Trump. Support Trump. Yeah. And you're like, whoa. But this was back in the days of when InfoWars was much more of a legitimate force for good in the conversation in the world. And Jason was a part of the crew there. And he did the really critical, the first huge 9/11 conspiracy video was Loose Change. And he was one of the guys behind it. So I got to have him on again today talking about, you know, the anniversary, 9/11, and of course, where we are now. And like one thing I got to appreciate about, I hate to say his version of the Alex Jones analysis, because he looks at the world in ways like similar to Alex Jones that are unique even among independent media, but without all the craziness and silly hyperbole and just logical fallacies that Alex Jones brings into it. But even Jason was like, well, I got to support Trump as the lesser evil, and I'm voting out of fear. It's like, oh, my God, no. Even you, you're – and he's like, yeah, I hate Trump. I'm like, no, oh, yeah. And so we had a great debate about that today. And the reason I say all that is he identifies – I talk about the super class. And I think as libertarians, we often fixate a little bit too much – on the institutions of government and not so much the great financial powers behind them. And I think he does a really good job of that. And he calls them the predator class. I don't really like that term because there are a lot of small scale predators, but you know what I mean, Dan, right? The super class of like the several hundred or
like
thousand.
Those are the 1% of the 1% of the 1%.
Yeah. Not even one of 1%. Yeah. I mean, there's, 8 billion people on the planet now, and I'm talking about a few hundred. And most of those don't actually hold government positions. And, trust me, I'll bring this back to Bill Weld and Lincoln Chafee and
he's
Justin
one of them.
Bosch and all these fake libertarians coming in thinking they're going to represent the Libertarian Party. But I could have, when Jason Burmes said he was voting for Trump, I could have turned on him, right? I could have turned on him and said, oh, fuck you, you're one of them. And I think even when you're talking about the super class and, you know, okay, fuck those 300 people, whatever, shoot, kill, whatever them, I have world better off. Hard to have sympathy for them. But for everybody else who's misled or the product of their own childhood trauma that leads them to whatever insecurities lead them to their evil politics and manipulations of society and whatnot, even them, sympathy for the devil, man, but these aren't the devil, these are human beings. And it's really important to have that empathy. And as an activist, I think there's another line. I think there's another important distinction that we need to make. There are people actively working towards evil, serving evil out of ignorance. There's the masses of the population that go along with that. And then there are those of us who are the activists who are pulling towards good. And even Bill Weld, after meeting him and becoming friends with him and understanding how much I disagree with him, I ended up having to really respect him because he was CFR, Council on Foreign Relations. He was a two-term Republican governor of Massachusetts. And he's not flying around on private jets sniffing kids right now. He, you know, or at least in 2016 and, you know, leading up to 2020, what was he doing? He was schmucking around with us in the Libertarian Party. That puts him on our side of the fight. And I really want to celebrate, and I want to strengthen this common sense of identity not just among libertarians, but everybody who recognizes the worldview that I just laid out and understands that if we don't hang together, we hang separately. And yeah, I'm sorry. I thought you had more important things to talk about than letting me ramble to make this point about why I love Bill Weld.
It is really a great point, because like throughout the debates and everything, they were always throwing questions at us like, what are you going to do to stomp out Trump? And it's like, okay, if this is what you want, you're going to get a candidate who's going to go out there and say how Trump is a horrible person, and you're going to lose his entire support base and you're never going to win them over. Meanwhile, like, I've talked to like some of the most ridiculous hardcore Trump supporters that are just like, yeah. And then I'm like, well, yeah, we should. Yeah. What? Yeah. Trump made some nice tax cuts, but we should get rid of the entire IRS. Oh, well, I think Trump said he was going to do that. No. He never said he was going to do that, but I'm going to do that. Oh, well, maybe I'll give you a follow, but I'm definitely voting for Trump in 2020. So I didn't alienate them. I didn't tell them to, you know, like, go get lost or, you know, go sink your boat somewhere. Like, I told them, I told them, like,
hold on, is that the new ultimate retort to a Trump, a MAGA-tard? Oh, yeah, go sink a boat.
Yeah, I mean, like, how many libertarians have sunk their boats while trying to lose their guns off their boat? we're not the most responsible either. But my point is, like, you most people in the Libertarian Party, most of them, they're still not even full libertarians yet, but they're getting there. And they were worse when they first started even looking at the Libertarian Party. So it's like, we shouldn't be turning people around. We should be guiding them with more information and you know, not chasing them away. And I think that's like
persistence and love.
Yeah. And that's super. That's just like what you're talking about. So yeah, I can totally appreciate that.
If I may, Dan, I want to share with you another talking point that I came up with on my show recently. And I think you'll appreciate this because it's kind of brutal, but in a way that really reveals the deceptive nature of the state. And I think is really critical to how people get sucked into supporting, you know, the red faction or the blue faction of the American Socialist Party. And I'm talking about when Trump announced, or I don't know if I think it was the White House technically announced that he is going to announce that he was going to be bringing home.
Yeah, why are you preparing? You're always preparing. Just go.
He's going to milk this fucking opportunity. What was the announcement? Oh, we're going to bring a few thousand troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you don't read past the headlines, if you're not skeptical, even as an informed libertarian, you go, wow, that's great news. Trump is doing the libertarian thing. No, not even fucking close. And I'll explain the point on this, because I do think it's important for people who are watching, who are going to absorb this, to have the background and the ammo. Trump pretending to be anti-war is countered by a few major facts. One, the general continuation of troops deployed overseas. He said he wanted to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's bringing thousands home after being president for 3.5 fucking years.
Right.
Where the hell were you? Now you want to pander? But the thing is, he's not even doing that, because we know he's bringing home less than half. And there's a normal fluctuation in troop movements in today's U.S. military empire, where we have thousands of troops in countries all over the world. But also, drone strikes have actually gone up under Trump. And no one's talking about that, because they have to point out, in order to do so, that they went way up under Obama after Bush. And the liberal media, who wants you to vote Biden now, is not going to do this. Thanks to someone on Twitter who just mentioned this in an argument with someone else that I happen to be watching in on. They said, Google Trump's 8 vetoes and what 5 of them have in common. And I Googled that, and like, it didn't give me anything. So I actually looked up the list of Trump's vetoes. He has vetoed 8 bills. 5 of them were about scaling back militarism. Some of those, absolutely unobjectionable. It's like Congress, U.S., the U.S. House and the Senate said we should stop selling arms to these countries this way. Trump veto. He is absolutely a pathetic fucking tool of the military-industrial complex. So the analogy that I came up with, and Dan, I really actually, as someone who's messaging and branding brilliance, I respect, I want your take on this, because it is a little brutal. I mean, you use pedophiles in an analogy, you know, it invokes a lot for a lot of people. We as libertarians should celebrate Donald Trump bringing the troops home the same way, in this instance, the same way that we would celebrate a pedophile giving a kid candy in order to lure him into his van. You don't stop in that situation and go, oh, that's great. There's a kid getting some candy. Well, I want kids to have candy and be able to enjoy sweet things. What kind of madman does that when they understand, when they see the white windowless van in the parking lot and a creepy dude going, here, kid, have some candy. That's exactly what we're getting from Trump. Now, I don't think it's actually Trump. Jason Burmes pointed out something really interesting to me on the show today, that multiple times Trump has promised to release these still classified documents from the JFK assassination. And that's how he hooked a lot of Alex Jones supporters into being MAGA-tards. Oh, look, we're gonna release the documents. And then he didn't. Both times it came up for him as an opportunity, he declined. Which makes me think they've got him by the balls the exact same way. So anyway, Dan, about that,
unless he's just bait happy. I mean, because think about it. And to the point of your analogy, it's bait, right? I mean, like the candy, you can give the candy away and it costs nothing to replace it. But what happens when you run out of candy? And if the candy is we're bringing home 10,000 troops, well, like if you brought them all home, you wouldn't have any more candy, right?
Right.
So, the analogy, it fits really well. My only hesitation would be, well, I guess first my question would be, what's the purpose? What are you trying to achieve? And who are you trying to attract with it? Because
I think if I was going for hypersensitive, you know, liberal SJWs who would be triggered by the word pedophile, then it's probably a brutal analogy that might not be appropriate for people who want to engage in politics that way. But for the alt-right and, you know, principled small government conservative types, I don't think they're going to shy away from this. And I think they need that kind of slap in the face, because a lot of them have become anti. If you notice, this is one of the most, and I will say what's worth celebrating is that Trump still needs to look anti-war to pander to his base.
Right.
His base, and you think not his base necessarily, but that alt-right paleocon part of his base, they are genuinely anti-war at this point. And I want, you want to talk about 9/11, get to what you meant to talk about with me?
And believe me, we're dancing around some of these other questions. Yeah. I am going to get to, but
I want to take credit for that, for my work with Iraq Veterans Against the War.
So it might be right for certain purposes, but like for, it's like what we talked about, like you have to make friends, not enemies, right? Because if you go, I mean, look at Biden, right? I mean, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that he is a pedophile. And you put that information in front of somebody who supports Biden, and like that, like forget an analogy, think about the actual act, and they will deny, no, that's not true. No, he's just like sniffing kids. There's nothing pedophile about that.
He's just a little weird and creepy in his affection. Yeah, no bullshit.
Exactly. So if somebody's in love with Trump and you try to use an analogy to compare him to a pedophile, then it's like, but like
in this analogy, I don't think Trump is actually the pedophile. I mean, he's the pedophile includes Trump, but in this analogy, the pedophile is the entire duopoly power structure that panders with fake anti-war shit.
See, that might be a good angle. If you really get a lot of people to make that connection, so that when they see bringing 10,000 troops home is just candy, it's just bait, and not associate that with Trump, let them make that association on their own.
Yeah, good point. Well, fuck it, Dan. I'm not about to put it on a poster. We have more important things to talk about.
Well, okay. So I did want to, like, one of my first questions that I wrote down was why you joined the military. And the reason I wanted to talk about this is because really for some of the same things we've already been talking about, a lot of libertarians hate the military. Oh, you bootlicker, you baby killer, like all these things, right? And at the same time, these are generally, well, I want to get your opinion because you've been there. You're not a fan of the military at this point.
About as anti-militarism to the core as you can get.
So how, like, what? So why did you join? What was going through your head when you actually joined? And what did it really take to make you shift to, like, hey, this is wrong?
Well, to jump ahead, and I'll get back to answering your question directly, but where you were going with that, like, is most of the military, you know, the base of the troops, you know, they're certainly not there for, I mean, the vast majority are not there for the sort of evil reasons. What?
Malintent. They're not there, like, right. Yeah, let's go kill some brown people.
Right. I mean, and that is a portion, and it's probably more today than it was when I was in, because the pool has been polluted so much. For me, I got to give a little personal background first, because I was not raised libertarian or liberal or conservative. My parents were both mostly apolitical, but generally libertarian in attitude. And they did not have the explicit understanding of the world of why be against authority. And I'm not saying, you know, when I say anti-authority in this sense, I'm not against all authority. I'm against all illegitimate authority. You know, if you have a legitimate intellectual or organizational or business or audience or expertise authority, yeah, that's great. Totally. We're not talking about that. But they never gave me any kind of greater worldview understanding. And it's funny, not just because of me, but now both of them have it a lot more, obviously. They both read my book, of course. Freedom, in case you're wondering. And yeah, you get it on Amazon, search Kokesh. My website is down. Yeah, surprise, surprise.
What?
No, it's not. I don't know if it's anything nefarious yet. It might just be poor organization on my part. But when I joined the Marines, a big part of it was to get away from my parents because of their divorce. I loved and still love both of them, and I have positive relationships with both of them, and I'm grateful for how they raised me and the benefits that I had as a child because of them. But when they were, after the divorce, and it was a pretty nasty one, and custody battle and financial fighting and all that, a lot of court hearings, and they were pretty reserved and not talking trash about each other in front of us as kids. So that was good, but it was ugly, and it wasn't kept from us. And we had to do a week alternating custody. A week with one, a week with the other, going to the same school, driving around. And I wanted to get away from that. And I wanted a sense of self-sufficiency, which is really ironic, joining the Marines. I mean, there is a legitimacy to that argument to say, I'm going to face a big challenge and grow, and I'm going to be helped in facing that challenge by this brotherhood of Marines. And it is a very deluded, misguided brotherhood. As we like to call it even back then, Uncle Sam's misguided children. But that I knew that, you know, if I ever was broke, desperate, homeless, whatever, you know, and I joined the reserves to go to college and then volunteer to go to Iraq. But like I could have gone on active duty at any time and had three hots and a cot. And that was part of the appeal for me. But at a deeper level, I genuinely wanted to have my life on the line for something I believed in. And at the time, I believed that the U.S. military, and especially the Marine Corps, hoorah, had a net effect of peace upon the world. And that is not just ignorant. It is so dangerously naive as to make it inexcusable to join the military. I cannot excuse what I did to say that I was conditioned, propagandized, put in a bad situation. No, I bear responsibility for supporting the military-industrial complex with 6.5 years of my life and putting it on the line for bankers, politicians, and war profiteers. And at an even deeper level, Dan, you know the movie Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah.
Has everybody seen that? I guess young people have, and it's a bit older now. But even I didn't see it when it came out. When I watched it, I was in high school. And it was already something like, what, 10, 20 years old? And for those of you who don't know, spoiler alert, at the end of the first half of Boot Camp in the movie, not the first half of Boot Camp, the first half of the movie is Boot Camp. One of the guys there shoots the drill instructor and himself. And part of what I thought was, if this is a challenge that can lead someone to suicide, I want to survive that challenge. But there's even one level deeper here. And it is based on this movie, because this movie was intended as an anti-war film to expose the brutality of militarism. And yet, to my young testosterone-fueled teenage brain, it was still a glorification of war. And there's one line in there from the Joker who says, I wanted to be the first kid on my block with a confirmed kill. And he's joking when he says that. But I wasn't joking for the part of me that meant it. And I actually said at the time that if my government decides someone needs to die, I want to be the one pulling the trigger, because I want to be the agent of righteous violence to defeat the evil bad guy, the boogeyman, the commie, the terrorist, whoever the government decides the bad guy is. And I think that is still what is largely preyed upon by militarism and by government. And even as libertarians, we're tempted to celebrate righteous violence. You know, I want to make jokes about Kyle Rittenhouse because he really is heroic for what he did. And at first I was skeptical. I saw in the video, yeah, that's self-defense. Yeah, that's self-defense. And I got to say, if someone was coming at me with a handgun and I had an AR, I do not think that I would have the presence of mind and skills and confidence in my skills to shoot that assailant in the arm instead of the head or the chest. Kyle Rittenhouse actually saved someone's life in the most direct, immediate risk to his own. If he had missed that shot at his elbow, and who knows, maybe he was shooting for the torso and missed, but even then, totally justified. And it's tempting for us as libertarians to say, yeah, the guys who deserved it got it. No, they didn't, because they didn't deserve to be there in the first place. Kyle's victims deserve to get shot in those moments that they were being violent, attacking him, threatening his life. But if you step back a second, you go, well, why were they there?
Right.
Were they hired? Were they propagandized? Were they traumatized? Were they lied to themselves? Fuck yeah, they were. And I guess that's an extra conclusion to answer your question. I think
That's a really interesting point about how, I mean, ultimately, like, you look at everything that's going on in the world today and it's escalated from something. And like, it really didn't need to be, but you have all these people who are working for the government, who are these politicians who are provoking us. Like, I've seen clips of Biden provoking all the riots and everything. Trump kind of in a way provoking them. It's like, if you guys would have just shut the fuck up and said, hey guys, you don't need to use violence, especially against small businesses. That's the libertarian side of it. Guys, like, if you're my supporters, step down a little bit. Don't be so angry at the other side.
hope after Kenosha was that that's what was going to happen, and people would have to take a collective sigh and deep breath and step back and go, oh, fuck, what are we doing? But no, the madness has only escalated. And both Trump and Biden have given lip service to, well, we're against the violence. Either one of them could come out and really powerfully step in and address it directly and say, guys, if you want to support me, don't do this. And neither of them has, to my knowledge.
Right. And it's, yeah, and it's the, you know, also to your point about escalation. I mean, look, you look at the, I say this about the Middle East, like going back to Israel and like the Jews versus the Arabs and all this stuff. And it's like both sides are completely in the belief that they're acting solely in self-defense for the most part. Maybe not some of the leaders of those, but like for a lot of the people in those nations, it's, you know, they're of that belief. No, those people are trying to kill us. And when you're, I mean, stalemate. How do you, like, that's, nobody is ever going to be wrong. Nobody is ever going to be unjustified. And so, like, you can imagine, like, what's going on in the U.S. If we have two sides that are fighting against each other, and one side is always like, well, I had to kill that guy because I knew if I didn't, he was going to get me. And it's just like, oh, and then it's like, oh, now we have to go capture this guy and arrest this guy because he killed somebody. And of course, that's going to lead to that guy defending himself. So someone's going to get killed there. And then, oh, somebody else got killed. We have to arrest that guy. And or when I say arrest, like either by government arresting or by the other side of the angry mob going to get that guy, which is what happened to Kyle Rittenhouse, right? The mob was after him because they were trying to arrest him because he had just shot somebody else. And it's like, okay, so now you're going after him. Now he's justified in defending himself. Now another one's dead over here. And you just escalate and escalate. And we have to, just like you said, take a step back and learn how to de-escalate from these situations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. By the way, Dan, fun sidebar, with all this racism stuff, isn't it fun being an anti-Zionist libertarian Jew?
Oh, man.
I'm enjoying it.
You know, it's funny, like, because sometimes I get into it with people who are just like very like quiet anti-Semites. Like I was sitting down at the airport talking to this guy, and I don't remember. I think this was like before I was all taxationist theft, and we just started having this conversation. I was definitely in the Fed at that point. And so we had a conversation. I was talking to him about that, and I started talking about the banks and all this other stuff. And then this guy says, yeah. And it's all the Jews behind it. And I was like, whoa, hold on there, buddy. I was like, I'm Jewish and I'm on your side. And he was like, oh. And like, that's all it took. And he was no longer anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of subtle racism out there for people who start studying the crimes historically of the banking class in the world and go, wow, Jews are really overrepresented there. And it's true. But I'd like to, and if you just point out, well,
you know, I'm not getting my cut.
In the back of their mind, they're probably going, is it just a coincidence? Is it really just a coincidence that the banking class is dominated by Jews, or is it something about the Jews? And I by the way, Dan, are you purebred or are you mixed?
I don't know the difference.
No, how Jewish hair, are you, so, by? Huh?
I don't have curly hair, so.
No. How Jewish are you by ethnic heritage?
I couldn't say. Both of my parents were, and grandparents from all over Europe. So it's
mostly, but you don't know how pure. Right?
Yeah. Honestly, I used to look at like. Like when we were kids, like people would always ask, like, oh, what are you? Where are you from? Who's and like I used to think, because we would have all these conversations about racism back then, and I would think, like, if we're sitting here talking about where we came from, isn't that contributing to the division of what makes us different and contributes to racism? So like I never really started digging into my family tree that way.
I don't know. If you do it for the wrong reasons and you take the wrong conclusions and you turn it into ethnic pride, you know, right, as opposed to just personal understanding and love and appreciation for yourself and how you got
here. I'm just a human being. That's, yeah. I mean, well, yeah.
I, I know for myself that I'm only about half Jewish and the other half is mostly German. So it's really fun. I don't know which half to hate more, but that gets to my theory about Jews in the banking class, because I don't want to deny this reality that, I mean, is it a fair statement, Dan, that the banking class generally is, Jews are overrepresented in the banking class and the current authoritarian power structure, right?
Yeah, in the entire authoritarian structure or just the banking part of it?
Well, banking and the elite part that's attached around it, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so Jews are overrepresented. So, but there are a couple of reasons, I think, that explain this more than Jews are evil or that any particular race has any particular inclination to evil. And one is that Jews are smarter generally than other ethnicities by statistics, right? There are a lot of ways you can pick that apart. And I'm not trying to say that we're smarter in any true sense, but by those metrics, right? And we, like we the Jews, as in we the not half Germans. But yeah, I mean, I like talking about
the Germans are amazing engineers too. So you got to figure some of them are pretty smart.
Well, so I think the reason that Jews are so high on the ethnic intelligence test is not because we're inherently genetically smarter, but you killed all the dumb ones. Everybody who wasn't smart enough to avoid all the various persecutions that Jews have experienced. I think we were just another, you know, gypsy class that just got particularly persecuted. And so when any ethnic group goes through a cleansing experience and comes out cleaner as a result. No, but who are the people who are victimized?
That's a really interesting point. Cause like when I was a kid and I was like hearing all about the Holocaust and like, you know, oh, they'd be like, they'd go door to door and like, are you Jewish? And oh, you're Jewish, we'll kill you. Like I used to think like, well, why wouldn't they just say we're not Jewish? And you have like, I mean, think about like a lot of, and I don't want to call people stupid, but you have a lot of people who are like, haven't grown out of the small mindedness of being proud about something. That comedian Doug Stanhope talks about being proud about something
nationalism
that you didn't accomplish. Yeah.
Nationalism makes you hate people you've never met and take pride in things you had nothing to do with.
Right. And when it's that's interesting that's a nationalism too, as just as a racism is, right? Where you're proud of your own race or your own nationality. Like that's kind of like, to me, that would be like, well, all you have to do is say you're not Jewish and we won't kill you. And it's like, no, I'm too proud to say that. I'm Jewish, damn it. And then it's like, oh, yeah. Well, off to the camps.
And so it's the shrewd, and not necessarily the smart one, but the street savvy and shrewd one who are able to avoid these kinds of persecutions, right?
And is that genetic or is that something that's, I guess, to some degree that there's some correlation between genetics and intelligence.
A product of selection. And well, there's so much. We don't need to get into that, but I do want to, as long as we mentioned Germany, World War II, and the Holocaust, Dan, I would be remiss to not expose myself as a Holocaust revisionist. And I'm not a denier. And it's important to not be slandered with that term because it really is a way that people dismiss people challenging the mainstream historical narratives that we're living under that define our understanding of the world that really need to be challenged and revised, especially now in the age of the internet, when facts are much harder to deny and cover up. But the fact is there was no large scale deliberate extermination of the Jewish people in World War II. Jews, Gypsies, Poles, and other minorities were hugely targeted, and 1 to 2 million of them died in labor camps. And that is the Holocaust. And that is still a horrific historical tragedy that doesn't need to be exaggerated to learn the lessons of it. But the reason that we have the mythology of World War II that we do is in order to justify the militaries that we have today and the militarism that we have experienced since then. 50 to 60 million people died in World War II. And the modern era had seen nothing like that. After a period of relative peace from World War I to World War II, the governments needed an excuse to justify this unheard of widespread destruction. And the mythology of the Holocaust as we know it today, and the creation of the Jewish state largely grew out of that. So this also relates to the phenomena that we see today, that it results in anti-Semitism, which is why I never say that I'm anti-Semitic. I'm anti-Zionist, because that means that the Jewish people should have a state. I don't, first of all, I'm against statism, as you know.
Right.
But ethno-statism, yeah, you have the right to form a community and an independent whatever on whatever criteria you want, but that's a disgusting idea, and I don't want any part of it. And I think the Jewish people have largely been misled by this myth and by this history to fervently support Zionism and its lies and its aggression and its AIPAC perversion. That's American Israel Political Action Committee that is responsible for so much pro-Israel lobbying within the United States. I think this, and that understanding of history, I think leads to a much more empathetic view of the Jewish people, even for those who do recognize, oh yeah, there are a lot of evil, or excuse me, there are a handful of really powerful, super rich, evil Jewish motherfuckers pulling some of the biggest strings in the world right now. And you can understand that that is a product of this history as much as everything else that the Jews have experienced over our history.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say, because you know, empathy was, I mean, that's like the whole reason behind, you know, oh, 6 million. Oh, wow. Let's give them some empathy. Let's give them their own state, right? And what was really interesting, somebody, I don't remember who, they said the best propaganda ever in the entire world was when Israel put the Star of David on the flag, because they created a state, right? A government, a militarized government, with the illusion that that government was not a government. It was a religion. And it was a religion that had already suffered a tremendous loss and should never be fucked with. And that's really amazing, because if you say anything against Israel, you are viewed as an anti-Semite, which is like, wait, hold on. Where's the connection here? You've got Hasidic Jews in Israel who denounce the existence of an Israeli state. They say there is no Jewish state. The Torah forbids it. And even if it was, why is it? I mean, the Torah, the Old Testament, right? It's a book of laws and rules and commandments and all these other things, right? So why would you need a new state with a legislative body to create? If this is a Jewish state, then it should, no, you already got your book. You already got your rules. It's already written. And
well, Dan, I can tell you the answer to that question right away. Without your own state, you can't sink the USS Liberty in 1967 and get $40 billion in foreign aid from the U.S. government every year. Right. And it is a ripoff. It is. I think Ron Paul said it best. I don't know if he's the first one to say this, but that foreign aid is taking money from poor people in rich countries to give to rich people in poor countries. You, the American people, are being taxed to support the rich assholes behind the state of Israel, those who are profiting from it.
The moral of the story is stop paying your taxes.
Yes, thank you, Dan Taxations that Berman. Did you want to talk about 9/11 today? It is September 11th. We've talked about pretty much every other sensitive topic we could today. Oh, I want to admit something. I'm racist. I think the lizard people are superior and all other races must submit. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, anything else? Pedophilia, Holocaust denialism. Yeah, what else can we talk about? Pissing off Trump supporters, Biden's pedophilia. What did we miss? What did we miss? Huffing glue? No, I don't know. What else can we get to?
The thin glue line.
We haven't talked about Corona. I mean, I did mention it to say that, just in passing, that, you know, and with my show today, and thank you for, you know, giving me the chance to give that sort of synopsis of my show this morning, because it was an important one for me. You know, there's some, like, I do my show 5 days a week. We're on episode, you know, 500 something, and I've, or four something, I don't know. And I've done so much media, but there's some that hit you and you go, fuck, that was a good show. But the coronaphobia crisis, you know, you and I think the way that Jason and I sort of try to put our heads together today, we should do a little, to serve our audiences here, do a little bit of that, because the only way that I could describe what we are experiencing right now globally as the coronaphobia, hoax, pandemic, outbreak, racket, whatever you, a swindle, whatever you want to call it. And just, I'm not a virus denier either. There's a real virus.
The idea but you have that to be one of the extremes. You can't, what are you in the middle?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Heaven forbid. No, but the, you know, the idea that the virus represents any kind of unique threat that warrants any special government action is absolutely a hoax, top to bottom. And the only way I can describe it is that there's this dark cloud hanging over everything right now. And even this conversation between you and I, talking about 9/11, thinking about what was Jason Burmes? And like, I can't say I was paying attention back then. I didn't even get out of the Marines till November 30, 2006 and started to wake up at that point. I was vaguely libertarian. I had already, you know, been active as a libertarian, but I was totally, you know, statist, minarchist, socially conservative, fiscally, socially awkward, fiscally, no, socially liberal, fiscally conservative. And I didn't start actually what I would describe as waking up, you know, looking at the world with the intent of creating a more empowering and accurate worldview for myself until I got out of the Marines. And even before then, there were great minds like, and I don't know where, we don't go back that far, but like Jason Burmes, who during that time was going, guys, this is fucked. You cannot let them pass the Patriot Act. You cannot let them use this as an excuse to birth the surveillance state as we know it today. I can't say birth the surveillance state. Birth the modern surveillance state, though. Yeah, for sure. Wiretapping, all the digital electronic surveillance took off after 9/11. DHS, TSA, so much more power concentrated in alphabet soup agencies. And there were people like that looking ahead. And even since then, I've been kind of complacent. I don't want to say not complacent, because I've been an activist since I got out of the Marines. Sort of accepting as normal this state of affairs. And Jason Burmes was pointing out to me today that the kinds of things that him and others were predicting after 9/11 are only now coming to fruition, either peeking over or right over the horizon. Contact tracing, forced testing, forced quarantine, forced vaccinations. If you don't test positive, you don't get your freedom pass. The business shutdowns, and really, I don't want to even be distracted by any of that, because Dan, you know as well as I, the primary purpose of government is to keep the rich getting richer while the poor get poor, right?
Yep.
I mean, you wouldn't disagree that that's one way of capturing like the core purpose of government. And what we just saw, and it's in the open. Look at how much money Jeff Bezos has increased his fortune by. Literally fucking insane. And I mean, part of me, like, and you know, I feel like a whiny liberal college freshman girl coming home to whine to her conservative dad after one semester. How can you have all this money when people are suffering? How can you ignore the suffering of the world? But when you look at a motherfucker like Jeff Bezos, who bought the Washington Post to be his propaganda arm, you know, independent from him, of course. You go, no, you're one of them. You're one of them. You're not one of us. You're not one of the people being blindly led along. You're not one of the people fighting for good. You're one of the people fighting for evil, holding back humanity to enrich yourself. That's fucking evil. And I came up with the number 9 trillion after it was 3 trillion, then 6 trillion, then another 3 trillion. But now what, do you know what it is, Dan? How much extra money has been created with a virus less deadly than testifying against Hillary Clinton as the excuse?
Last I saw, the monetary base was they ended up printing an extra trillion, which was like 30 to 40%, and that was over a month ago when I checked.
But that was so actually like, printed, created, put into the physical
right,
money.
Right. So once it recycles, yeah, exactly. So once it recycles through the fractional reserve system, it's like that's got to be like another, I don't know, 10 trillion something.
Yeah. Well, by the legislation, the emergency spending, it was 9 trillion at one point, and it's more than that now. And that's liquidity. And by what you're saying is the extrapolation with fractional reserve banking and how that empowers banks to make loans. And it's worth pointing out for any libertarian watching who hasn't figured this out yet, most of the money being created out of thin air is not created by the Federal Reserve. It's created by individual banks with fractional reserve banking making loans. Of course, it's all part of the same system. I'm not trying to say the Fed's not the heart of it, but it's an important...
Well, the Fed sets the fractional reserve rate, which all the other banks have to obey. So they're
right.
Really, it's a franchise operation.
Right, I mean. Right. But my point in this is that it's because of the FDIC and the Fed backing up the banks. Yeah, it's really like a network.
Might as well be one. You know? Yeah.
But they empower the banks to engage in fractional reserve banking without market liability that you would have in an honest free market voluntary system. So this and it's. So it's suicide rates. I mean,
insane.
22 veterans. And you know, this is something that I talk about a lot. 22 veteran suicides a day.
And that's got to be up right now, I would imagine.
They're not even able to fully keep track of it because so much is being deliberately misrepresented and obfuscated and in the statistics, but also people are being kept from healthcare. I primarily as a result of my combat experience, PTSD, I have trouble sleeping. It's a bit of poetic justice irony that the thing that haunts me the most about what I did in Iraq was engage in a sleep deprivation, torture, a shift. I did a shift guarding a few detainees who were zip tied with their hands behind their backs, sandbags put over their heads, and forced to sit cross-legged on a floor for hours to, you know, soften them up for interrogation. And they don't get tortured there either. It's just enhanced interrogation. But they were not allowed to move. They had to sit up and they couldn't get up. They couldn't get up to go to the bathroom. So, you know, by the time I got to guard them, I was, they were sitting in their own excrement, let's just say. And I used the Arabic that I learned in order to be better at my job in civil affairs, connecting with the Iraqi people to serve them, to do well. I used it to taunt them, to keep them awake. And the idea that militarism can pull out that greatest, even from, like, and I explained earlier, my mentality going into this, and why I volunteered to deploy was because I wanted to clean up the mess. I was against the invasion of Iraq as an active Marine reservist, and I volunteered to go to Fallujah in 2004 because I thought that what we were doing in the occupation after the invasion was somehow responsible foreign policy now, cleaning up our mess and trying to do right by the Iraqi people. And I had to go to find out for myself that wasn't the case. And so just now, sorry for that sidebar, but to bring it back, I get Klonopin from the VA. And I use it like once or twice a week, you know, when I feel like, I got the time, I need to sleep, you know, 9-10 hours and catch up and feel rested. I can take a Klonopin and you know, that's okay. And it's something that I think is, along with cannabis, a reasonable positive way for me to manage my PTSD. All right. I ran out. So they give me, when I go to the VA, they give me like way more than I need. They give me one a day. You have a prescription for one a day. And it's like, I need one or two a week tops. And so I stockpiled it. And I went back when I ran out about 6 months ago, tried to make an appointment. It took 6 months to get the appointment that finally happened today. And you know what I had to do? I finally got pissed off enough. I called the White House Veterans Crisis Line. And I didn't know that that's what it was. I don't know if that's the exact title. Somebody else I was talking to is a as a vet rep suggested, well, hey, you know, why don't you, and they said, why don't you file a complaint with the White House Veterans Office? I said, oh, well, all right, you know what? There are enough people. This is not just me. This is not just the bureaucracy. There are a couple of people who work, and this is true. And by the way, I want to point out about the VA before I say this. There are a lot of great people who work at the VA, and most of the actual healthcare providers, the doctors and nurses and all their immediate assistants, are great people who do great work serving veterans who face the challenges and sometimes even take pay cuts in order to work at the VA. But the bureaucracy puts 1,000 bureaucrats between a veteran and them half the time. And from my experience with the Prescott VA recently, there are a good handful of people there who don't deserve those jobs. Yesterday, when I went in, I had to go in for in person for blood work first. And I don't wear a mask proactively ever. I mean, I do it all the time out here in Gardenia when I'm doing construction work and, you know, cutting wood and building shit and playing in the dirt. Yeah, I actually wear a bandana. I wore a face mask every day before it was cool. But no, in terms of like going out in public, I never wear a mask proactively. I think that's a very important way of us for a lot of reasons. If you want to get into that, we can. But for a lot of reasons, it's very important to assert that. But if someone, you know, if a small business owner says, please wear a mask in my shop, no questions. Absolutely. I'll do it if I want to shop there. I might have a conversation and challenge them. And if I don't like them, I might take my business elsewhere. But at the VA, hey, socialized medicine, man, you don't have a choice. And me as a vet, I can't afford, you know, regular health insurance somewhere else when I get what I get with the VA.
Right.
And I went into the lobby at the lab, and this is on my Twitter. And if anybody wants to follow me there, please do. I've been especially active on and appreciative of Twitter lately as a relatively low censorship platform. I posted the pictures of this guy, but I walked in, I sat down. He says, sir, you need to put your mask on. Hey, not, excuse me, sir, it's our policy. Would you please put your, hey, sir, put your mask on. No, thanks. I'd rather not. Thank you. Have a nice day. And he was persistent in bugging me. And then I was, you know, polite and distant, sir, I'd rather not talk to you right now. And he says, if you don't put a mask on, I'm going to call the police. Okay. All right. If that's, because I asked him before, how do you enforce this? How is this policy enforced? And he said, well, it's the director of the VA. It's her policy. She decided. I said, that's not what I asked. Who enforces it? How do you actually mean what you say? Or are you just blowing hot air?
Like, they don't even understand, like, and that's like typical statist rhetoric. They don't understand. No matter how small the law, you have to be willing to enforce it by killing somebody, or else it's just words on paper.
I pulled up my bandana, and I had it over my nose, wearing it properly. This is how I carry out my general mask policy today. Is I go until I run into that wall, and then, you know, then I address the wall, right? And I don't know if that's the right analogy here, but so I got up with my phone because I wanted to take a picture of his name tag, and he tried to stop me, and then he called the police so it wasn't for not wearing a mask, because at the end of our exchange about masks, I put it on. And if they were really fucking serious, if this was any kind of a real threat, there'd be a checkpoint at the goddamn door, not some idiot who, Karen motherfucker, doing this shit to you as a veteran when you come in, trying to just be sane and reasonable for a little bit and breathe. We called the cops. Finish this story.
Yeah, finish it.
So I got a picture of him calling the cops, and I was videotaping. I posted just a couple. It wasn't like, it's not a great video. It's a dumb, I don't want people to waste time watching this video because it's just dumb. But he called the cops. I took some screenshots, and the cop came, and he was like, and he talked to this guy first, who looked like a nurse. I was wearing some kind of scrubs and a mask. And then I'll just call him the nurse, goes and talks to the cop, and the cop looks at me, and I'm recording. And he goes, so it seems like nothing's the problem here, right? And I go, that's correct, officer. As long as you assert that I have a right to record here. I know it's not public, but this is a public lobby. I'm a veteran. I have a right to be here. This gentleman is working for the government. He should be accountable by video and photography for his actions, right? And the cop was totally chill. Cop was great. And I don't want this guy to get fired, the nurse even, for doing this, for being a Karen and for escalating. But you need to de-escalate in a situation like that, not escalating. There's no reason for him to call the cops. I had already submitted and put my mask on. I was compliant at that point, you know, and it just, this disparity in attitudes among government employees, like one right after the other, was really shocking to me, which of course goes to our original big point about empathy, right? About really remembering that these are human beings. And I'm just to get back to the bigger point of Corona and this dark cloud and suicides, how many people are going to die because they didn't get their routine or non-emergency, you know, medical procedures that got pushed back? How many are going to die from depression and suicide or from overdosing? And we're seeing those numbers are already being tallied in undeniable ways, far outpacing COVID deaths. To say the cure is worse than the disease is so overwhelmingly obvious, especially after, you know, the CDC's famous 6% numbers. But it's not even accurate to say that the cure is worse than the disease. It's the cure is a scam.
The cure is the disease.
Even better, because what is the real disease behind all of this? It's the government flu. It's statism. It's the sickness that leads us to this authoritarian and subservient mentality.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this too is so when Governor Abbott first made his declaration, his executive order, the first thing I thought of was like, wait a minute. There's an executive order that everybody has to wear a mask, but I don't work for him. Who's he ordering? Like, that doesn't apply to me. Yep. And what's interesting about your point about having a checkpoint at the door, when I went to the Texas convention a few weeks ago, I flew through Houston. And as I was sitting there, like I flew in from Mexico, so I had to leave and then go back through TSA. And as I'm going down the escalators after TSA into the terminal, there's like a big container right there that says, don't forget your mask. And there's a free thing, like, take a mask. And I'm like, wait a minute, isn't everybody supposed to be wearing it already? Then at the gate, they made an announcement that you have to have a mask. And if you don't have one, come to the gate and get one because we won't let you on the plane without one. Isn't everybody already supposed to have a mask? Then there's another announcement. The county has made an executive order that all residents must wear masks when indoors. And my first thought was, I'm not a resident. I'm here on a layover. Like, so I guess that's not me. And it's like, all of these questions come up and it's like, but if you give someone a badge and a gun and they're like, I have to enforce this executive order. I don't care who you are. You could tell it to the judge if you want. You don't think you have to follow it? Tell it to the judge.
Stanford prison experiment. They have deputized every single American as a Ken or a Karen to enforce this bullshit social distancing. And that is run rampant now. But Dan, we're way over time and I do have to go in a bit. I hate to do this to you because this is so much fun, but I do want to take a few minutes to turn to the positive and the solutions and where we go with this. And I want to ask you first, is this a step backwards or is this a new trend of humanity off into dystopia?
Well, I think, like you said earlier about people need a slap in the face, I think this is it for a lot of people. And I think there's always that different people have different thresholds. For me, I got slapped in the face by the government when I really snapped and said, fuck this, I'm going to burn the whole thing down, figuratively, of course. But like it took that. And I know for so many other people, it takes something different. I talked to a guy once, I was interviewing people coming out of the traffic court, And one guy, I was like, yeah, so what happened? And he's like, well, I thought I was innocent, but I have to pay my ticket. And I was like, okay, how'd you get the ticket? He's like, I was on the highway, and then there was this car behind me, and it was tailgating me, so I tried to switch lanes. But then it kept switching lanes behind me, so I kept switching lanes, and then like I couldn't get rid of him, so I started speeding up, and then he turned his lights on, and it was a cop. And so I was like, so did you win this ticket? And he's like, no, I lost it. And I was like, well, do you think that's right? And he's like, well, you would think this would be his slap in the teeth, where he would say, this whole fucking system is rigged. No. He said, well, I mean, really, I shouldn't have sped up like that. I shouldn't have kept changing lanes like that. And so I think everybody...
Hold on. In his defense on that point, Dan, was he saying, hey, I should know that there are road pirates out there who will fuck you if you give them any excuse, and I shouldn't have given them any excuse? Or was he really blaming himself for driving recklessly?
He was blaming himself for trying to protect his own life from what he believed was... could have been somebody that was going to carjack him or run him off the road or do whatever else.
Yeah.
So it's that. And I think like we're getting to this point where more people are recognizing, hey, this is wrong. But it's like, you know, the old saying, like, you know, first they came for the Jews.
Lefties.
Yeah.
First they came for somebody.
Came
for the Jews.
And I didn't say anything. And then it's like, yeah, and we're getting to that point. And some people are starting to wake up. But it's like by the time the rest of everybody wakes up, it's going to be like, sorry, guys, you know, that's it. What's going to happen? Are we just going to like, is society just going to collapse down to like nothing and then we'll rebuild?
So hold on, Dan, I think I can answer my question now sufficiently to complement yours here, because one of the things that I do in talking about libertarianism and talking about current events, as I do on my show, I'll plug it again, AdamVersusTheMan.com. I got a great crew behind me now, man. I have the best formula I've ever had with this production, and I, except for getting banned on YouTube today, it's been an amazing, you know, growth period for us. But this historical perspective is so important. But first, about the nature of this racket that is coronaphobia. Do you have a term for I just call it coronaphobia. Do you have a better term to describe the dark cloud that is this whole crisis right now?
No, I just call this standard operation, I guess. I
mean, it's not though. This is a significant spasm.
I think it is. I mean, it's growth. I mean, it's more than what we've had in the past, but it's always been growing. It's always been growing incrementally, and they've taken kind of a big step, but not really. I don't think
so. So when Corona first came out, and by the way, I'm very proud of the fact, if pride is not a sin, and in a non-sinful way, I'm very proud of the fact. Maybe satisfied is better. I'm so self-satisfied. That's less shameful than being prideful, right? But on February 1st, I did a podcast called The Coronavirus Hoax. Ron Paul did a column 1 month later, exactly on March 1st, called The Coronavirus Hoax. Yeah. Man, I feel like I'm just like pulling out so many facts in this hour that we've spent together. I hope someone goes, he's got to be wrong. I hope someone in the audience goes, he's got to be wrong about something. I'm going to fact check him. And I might have gotten a couple technical things wrong, but none of the shit I'm making up. I fact checked it all for myself. But I fell for the hoax myself before that. No, actually, it was after that. I'm sorry. This is even more embarrassing this way. After I did a podcast called The Coronavirus Hoax, I thought that I got it. Because I was with my wife and our driver on the bus, No Force One, as you know, and we were driving through Texas, and we had just been to the event. We had been to the Illinois State Convention, and then we were supposed to go to the Michigan State Convention, and you remember that was canceled. Mm-hmm. But I threw a Corona party there, and I'm so glad I did now. But even after that, there was a time I was led to be ashamed about that. Oh, Adam, you're being insensitive. Do you regret throwing that Corona party? And I had a big case of Corona beer in the picture promoting. I was like, yeah, I got that. A case of Corona I want to share with you. And now I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm glad I was there. I'm glad I did that. But even Adam motherfucking Civil Disobedience, stand up to the man Kokesh, fell for it afterwards in the sense that I thought I had it.
But I mean, that's the thing. One day there will be a virus like this, I'm sure, right? That will live up to what Corona was supposed to be. And it's like, it really doesn't matter. I mean, of course it matters if it's real or not, but it doesn't matter if it's real or not to the government, who's going to do, like, it's always growing. It's never shrinking. Government.
Well, Dan, I am gonna challenge that for you in a second here, and I got to wrap up. I really got to go. So let me just finish this point, because for me, for someone like you, someone like me, we have our heads in the news every day, and I have what I think is one of the greatest luxuries in life, as a result of being a podcaster, pundit, journalist, who gets to look at the world and come up with my own portrayal of it through Adam versus the Man to show my audience, this is what's important. This is what's going on in the world today. This is the story of humanity. And even with that advantage, it took me a few weeks to really fully process everything that was going on and to see through to the bottom of the bullshit. Most people don't have that luxury. And it's simply going to take them a lot longer. So in that sense, I'm still very, very excited for this being the slap in the face that a lot of people need. Now, the reason I mentioned my inclination to history, and I don't pretend to be some great student of history. I took my normal, you know, elementary, middle school, high school, you know, liberal arts, you know, college requirements for history, you know, basic shit. But in trying to understand the world as it is today, I have made myself a student of history for what is critical in understanding the fight for justice that we have taken on as libertarians. And the most important thing that I see in that is the work of Steven Pinker, Harvard professor, and I disagree with him on his conclusions and analyses and plenty of other things, but his one great intellectual gift to the world was that he proved academically, irrefutably, that we are living in the most peaceful times in human history. You are less likely today than ever before to be subject to violence at the hands of another human being. And this is the product of a long-term historical trend of violence on the decline, kind of a radioactive decay curve. And if you don't stop and keep this in, you can't just know this and hear this. This is something you really have to integrate into your worldview and your understanding of human history. And I see this as something much deeper. To me, it's a spiritual thing almost to acknowledge that this is the natural course of not just intelligent life, but life itself, maybe even the universe itself, to seek harmony. Multicellular organisms beat out single cellular organisms all up to today, where human beings who are able to cooperate are more successful than those who are always fighting. And while you pointed out that government has grown, and I don't dispute that at all in financial terms, I would have to ask you, and if you could, without getting too sidebarred into this little intellectual exercise, Dan, what is the measure of evil of government? How do you measure it?
Well, I think, okay, let's look at the word violence, right? The word violence comes from violate, right? And if why is there violence, right? Some people use violence to control somebody, right? So let's say you have somebody, you want them to do work for you, a slave. You beat them with physical violence until you break their will and they just do whatever you say. Now, at that point, they just do whatever you say. Is that now a nonviolent relationship? Or is there the threat of violence that is continuing that? So you can measure the actual counts of violence being hitting people, killing people, that type of violence, and say, yes, the world is more peaceful now because we have less of that. But do we have more people now who are out of just fear of what might happen to them, paying their taxes, all these other things?
Point taken. And this is the point that Walter Block, my friend Professor Block at Loyola University in New Orleans, makes to counter libertarians like myself who look at Pinker's claim or Pinker's academic proof of these numbers and says, well, yeah, but the world is being governed by coercion so much more. But here's the thought exercise, because you didn't actually quite answer the question, but you were getting towards it. And the thought exercise that I came up with to help libertarians answer this question is, would you rather live under a giant government that employs half the population, but is entirely peaceful and employs just enough coercion to maintain its monopoly on those services? And in those services, it provides pretty much what the market would provide. It just has a government label on it, and people are okay with it. And it's a happy, generally peaceful, productive society, and civil liberties are respected. Or would you rather live under a tiny government that murders 10,000 people at random every day? Yeah, you take the big government in that case, because the measure of government is, as I think you were getting almost right at, is not how big it is, but how much it coercively or violently takes us away from our potential as a species to have a state of harmony and peace and cooperation.
So then, could you look at it as not the numbers, stop measuring the government, but measure how many people are not affected in any negative way, affected, controlled, violated by a government, who are able to live absolutely freely?
Well, I think you could count it in lives and dollars and pain. How much pain does the government cause? How many people do they kill? How much actual physical freedom do they violate? But then also, how many dollars of value do they destroy? And in that sense, like I said, this is a spasm of statism. So much value has been destroyed in the last 6 months and stolen by, I call them the super class, not the predator class like Jason Burmes. But yeah, we're referring, I think, to more or less the same thing. The bigger point, though, that I want to make here, and I promised I'll end with this, is that the war rackets that governments have carried out in the past are simply no longer possible in the age of the internet. When people have the ability to connect the way that we do today with technology, you simply cannot convince millions of gullible young men to meet in a field where none of them live and kill each other because they're wearing different colors. So instead of, and I look at what we did with 9/11, let's bring it back to our theme of the day, right? 9/11, even at that point, what I just said about it being impossible for governments to get away with large-scale force-on-force wars was already true. In order to have any kind of war support for the military-industrial complex, they had to have this false flag event. And regardless, and I don't want to debate this or get into it, whatever you believe happened on 9/11, it almost doesn't matter, because it no way justified the invasions and continuing to this day occupations. At least, I don't know, I wouldn't call it an occupation at this point, because the military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan is very limited. It's not really occupying the whole entire country, but it is a kind of military occupation where policies in these countries are now being set by the American military empire, not by the people. Shocking, right? And they had to do that. They couldn't say, hey, look, everybody in Iran wants you dead because they're a bunch of moosey terrorists who hate America because you're free. And by the way, if they hate us because we're free, they got to love us now, if that's not cliche. Fuck, how long have we been saying that dumb line? But now, when they can't get away with war, they can't fake a terrorist attack, they have to fake a virus threat. And maybe the people are just learning. Maybe they'll only get away with this once. I think we're going to learn the lessons from this. I'm still very optimistic. I think compared to the war rackets not of our lifetimes, but going back to World War II, World War I, even before that, ancient wars were far more brutal. And the control that the tyrants who carried out wars in ancient times, or even just before, you know, the last couple hundred years, had more control over their populations. And you think, even just, and this occurred to me when we were talking about World War II earlier, never occurred to me before, but right now, everybody being enlisted to be a Ken or a Karen, pretty sad, pretty fucked up. Back then, what was it? Buy war bonds, collect metal scrap for the war effort. Everybody still had to be in on it and support the troops and support the nation, support the country, which means support the government and everybody who's profiteering off the war, even if you don't see it as that. This is not as bad. We are not going to see 50 to 60 million deaths like we saw in World War II. We are not going to see the same kind of, we are not going to see cities like Dresden firebombed. We are not going to see nuclear weapons dropped. And as ugly as things are right now, I think that with my understanding of human history, I can conclusively say that this is nothing more than one more big step backwards for humanity. But it's still a part of the general progression of our great dance forward to a voluntary society, to a state of greater love and harmony and peace and acceptance of our fellow human beings and respect for their freedom. So, Dan, I think I couldn't end it on a better note than that. Thank you for the opportunity to join you today to speak to your audience, especially when I'm so shadow banned. Every opportunity I can get to rant on someone else's platform and build my audience perhaps out of yours and help you build yours, I think that's critically important. I want to say one more thing to your audience in wrapping this up, to say thank you for making Dan's show possible. I think it's obvious enough. I'm not just a huge optimist, but I'm a big tech optimist as well. And if it wasn't for the internet, I mean, think about it. If this in World War II, would we even be able to have this conversation?
Right.
No. Fuck no. You talk locally in person, and then you get newspapers, radio, and maybe TV, right? And that's it. The decentralization of control from this technology is incredible. But it means nothing without conscientious application. And for those of us in independent media, in whatever form it takes, if you don't have corporate sponsorship, if you face the censorship that we do, the shadow banning, the deplatforming, the demonetizing, in order for people like Dan and I to do what we do, we require an active and engaged audience supporting us. So for everybody who makes Dan's production possible, thank you, Dan, for your persistence and your activism and all of the challenges that you've faced, of course, thank you. And with that, mwah, peace and love, y'all. Adam versus the man.
Give yourself a plug one more time before you head out.
Well, Adam versus
websites.
AdamVersusTheMan.com is the main one right now. You can follow me on Twitter at Adam Kokesh. You can send me an email, Adam@TheFreedomLine.com. Dan, when we did our last interview, did I show people what's going on here in Gardenia?
Yeah, we saw a little bit of it. No.
Because sometimes in interviews, I like to pick up my camera and go outside and show people a little bit of the awesomeness that is the Garden of Freedom. And I'd like to do that for you real quick, just for a moment here.
Let's see it.
Yeah, my phone's about to die, so if it cuts, that's why. And in the brightness out here, I can't see my screen at all, so I'm kind of guessing. But, you know, one of the solutions that Jason and I talked about today, and I know you're all for this, and, you know, living in a agorist lifestyle is in living by our values, not materially supporting the state or the evil institutions of the world, you know, with your labor and your consumer choices every day. I think this is the ultimate manifestation of it for me. I live off grid. By the way, there's no Force One. I live off grid on 10 acres in the mountains in Arizona. We call this the Garden of Freedom,
or Gardenia, or the Kingdom of Gardenia for short. As of July 4th next year, we are going to be the independent, sovereign, propertarian, constitutional monarchy of Gardenia. But the latest development is that a few weeks ago, actually a couple months ago, we had this wonderful cat wander onto our property pregnant. Just yesterday, finished building this epic cat house for her and her kittens, who are coming out because they heard my voice. Look at this. Look at this. Isn't this awesome? Hey, Pumpkin. This is, he's the orange one is Pumpkin. He's my favorite. Can you see that okay? Am I holding the camera all right?
Yeah, that looks great.
So today they're learning how to use the cat door. And my puppy is stuck up on the roof there. I don't know if you can see that. But anyway, I just it's 9/11. Fuck this holiday.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, man. This was an awesome talk.
Yeah, let's remember the kittens instead. Remember the as bad as things, man, is my lens dirty? Has it been this whole time? Anyway, remember the kittens. Remember that there is still plenty of love and beauty in the world, and it is absolutely worth fighting for and enjoying and appreciating at the deepest level of your soul possible every single day. And that's how I know Dan has the same beautiful, positive attitude behind what he does in his work. But for those of us activists on the front line, so to speak, it's a big part of what we do to stay grounded and stay centered and stay happy. So, you know, I always end my shows with, mwah, peace and love, y'all. Choose happiness and be excellent to each other.
Awesome. Thanks again, Adam, for coming on the show today. This was an awesome talk. I know we went way over time, but anybody listening, if you like this show, make sure to share it, tweet it, comment, like, repost, do all that stuff. Send it to your friends, email it, fax it, whatever you want to do.
Don't make wait sure to get for the it to appear in your YouTube feed because it won't.
Yeah, don't get me banned from YouTube. All right, guys. I'll see you again next week. Taxation is theft.
Girl, that's a good girl. Belly rubs. Belly rubs. Oh, belly rubs.
Oh, yeah, we got to end the show with the dog.
Are we
see
off?
You later, man.
All right.